banning Israel despite mounting international pressure and efforts by a growing number of Senate Democrats to block such sales. The Trump administration has already approved $12 billion in major military assistance to Israel this year. The deals are part of a 10-year U.S.-Israel military agreement that is nearing its end. Since October 2023, several countries, including Italy, Japan, Spain, Canada, Colombia, the Netherlands and Belgium, have halted arms sales to Israel over its carnage of tens of thousands of civilians in Gaza. Portugal has announced its intention to recognize a Palestinian state, joining a list of European countries that have made a similar decision as global outcry towards Israeli genocide continues. The Portuguese foreign minister says his country will officially recognize a Palestinian state on Sunday. It comes ahead of a UN General Assembly where around 10 other countries are set to follow suit. Lisbon has said the decision is because of the unprecedented level of Israeli carnage in Gaza, coupled with the regime's continuous annexation of Palestinian lands in the occupied West Bank. So far, 10 out of 27 EU countries have recognized Palestine. Britain, France and Canada are also among Western countries planning to recognize Palestine at the upcoming UN General Assembly. In South Africa, protesters have gathered at the new Amazon Web Services headquarters in Cape Town to voice their opposition to the company's collaboration with Israel. Beyond condemning Amazon's support for the Israeli regime, activists argue that the company's expanding presence in Africa facilitates the spread of Israeli surveillance and spying across the continent.
Amazon Web Services is complicit in the driving of genocidal tech in the occupied territories, shows a particular a combination that simply cannot be ignored, that these multinational corporations are enacting not just genocidally, but in the same mindset as colonial powers did, as the Dutch East India Company did.
The Israeli government gave Google and Amazon a contract worth $1.2 billion called Project Nimbus, and that has enabled the Israeli government to have endless data services. They have been able to get surveillance and technology, AI technology, to surveil Palestinians. There are a couple of programs baked into that, like Lavender and Where's Daddy?
The Israeli occupation force, okay. They are one of the most tech-hungry, you know, armies in the world. They use the computing power that companies like Amazon provide, you know, and the kind of algorithms that they help fine-tune on these things to target where the bombs are going to fall. So they are directly an enabling technology. I mean, just like, you know, a tank cannot run without petrol, this modern warfare cannot run without this high technology infrastructure that companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft are providing.
The Israeli regime has heightened security measures in the occupied Palestinian territories after a car incident in the Tel Aviv that left at least one Israeli dead. Israel's Channel 12 has reported the incident as a suspected car ramming attack. The driver reportedly fled the scene and a search is on the way to arrest him. Israelis inside and outside the occupied territories have faced multiple attacks since the outbreak of the regime's genocidal war in Gaza in 2023. On Friday, a man was arrested in the Netherlands for allegedly attempting to set fire to the Israeli embassy in The Hague. A day earlier, a Jordanian truck driver shot and killed two Israeli soldiers at the main border crossing between the occupied West Bank and Jordan. Israeli forces continue their violence across the occupied West Bank, carrying out more raids and abducting more Palestinians. We were earlier joined by our correspondent Indra Malahna Kahamad with the latest updates.
The entire city of Al-Khalil has been under attack since the hours of the morning. We are talking about almost 200 detentions, 200 arrests from inside Al-Khalil. In the villages of Abu al-Azja and Rabud to the south of Al-Khalil, 70 Palestinians have been abducted, and they are still under, until this moment, being captured by the Israeli forces, who are performing a large raid towards that area. Also in Beit Umar and to the north of Al-Khalil, and the Shiukh and Sa'ir, we are talking about tens of arrests among Palestinians. Of course, we have seen such actions in other cities, and in other villages, where hundreds of Palestinians being detained, and later they will they be released. But after they are captured for hours, they are fiercely interrogated, they are intimidated, they are humiliated, and most of the time they are severely beaten, to the extent that the Palestinian ambulance needs to take many of them towards the hospital. Like other raids happened throughout the West Bank. Over here in Ramallah, a confrontation happened between the Palestinians and raiding IOF forces.
The Committee to Protect Journalists has reported that 31 journalists and media workers were killed in Israeli airstrike on a newspaper complex in Yemen last week. The September the 10th strikes targeted offices of the newspapers 26th of September and Yemen Daily in the capital Sana'a. At least 22 journalists were also injured in the attacks. The regime's army claimed that it had struck military targets belonging to the Ansarullah resistance movement. The attack marked the deadliest single strike on the press since 2009, when 32 journalists were killed in an attack in Philippines' southern province of Maguindanao. Since the beginning of its genocidal war on Gaza in 2023, Israel has also killed hundreds of journalists in the Palestinian territory and Lebanon. In Sana'a, thousands of Yemenis rallied again this Friday against Israel and its allies, slamming the regime's genocide of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. They also sent strong warnings to Saudi Arabia. More in this report.
Yemeni and Palestinian flags draped the 70 square, as hundreds of thousands rallied in solidarity with Palestine, condemning U.S. and Israeli genocide in Gaza. Protesters also condemned Saudi Arabia and warned the kingdom of the dangers if it sides with Israel in any military operations against Yemen.
The Yemeni people are standing with Palestine against disgrace and humiliation. We are here in direct defiance against the U.S. and Israel. And we also send a warning to Saudi Arabia that if it gets involved in helping any of our enemies at sea, we will also deal with them.
Protesters also vowed that past Yemeni strikes prove Yemen's ability to hit back against Israel, U.S., and Saudi Arabia if necessary.
From this field of jihad, we tell the Zionists and the Americans that we will never fear your bombings on us. We will also send a message to those traitors, especially Saudi Arabia. Do not make the mistake of entering a battle you are not prepared for. Take heed of what we did to your Aramco facilities in the previous wars.
We condemn the failed Arab summit. They are only puppets of U.S. and Israel. We in Yemen stand firm as a mountain with our leader, and we will continue to attack by land, air, and sea against all enemies.
Yemenis are hoping for the best, but are preparing for the worst, an all-out battle with Israel and all its allies if the aggressions continue.
Yemen has stepped up its military operations, not only in support of Gaza, but to prevent what many believe is Israel's ultimate plan to take over parts of West Asia if the regime is not stopped immediately. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
The UN Security Council has rejected a bid to keep sanctions relief for Iran, paving the way for renewed UN sanctions within days. Iran has slammed the move, calling any attempt by the European trio to reimpose sanctions baseless and a direct assault on international law.
Iran implemented the deal in full and in good faith. No other nation has ever subjected itself to such rigorous, intrusive verification by IAEA. We kept our words, the EU, ETA, and US did not. It was the United States that unilaterally tore up the agreement in 2018, imposing sanctions in open defiance of this council. It was the ETA that failed to meet their obligation, hiding behind empty promises while quietly following Washington's lead and instructions.
Iran's ambassador to the UN, Amir Saeed Iravani, emphasized that in a striking display of hypocrisy, the European trio and the US claimed that Tehran must be punished for measures it took only years after enduring their violations. The three European countries triggered the snapback process last month, accusing Iran of breaching uranium limits set by the 2015 nuclear deal. That mechanism, which is set to expire on October 18th, allows any JCPOA participant to restore UN sanctions unless the Council votes to stop it. If no deal is reached by September the 28th, international sanctions suspended under the nuclear deal will automatically return. Political activist Mohsen Arabi earlier told us that Iran has been clear about the rollback of its obligations in compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. He said it is Western governments and not Iran that violated the deal.
Iran's position is quite clear. Like, they consider this attempt by these three European states to reinstate annulled UN Security Council sanctions as unlawful, unjustified, and provocative. This action in itself, it undermines basic norms of diplomacy at a very sensitive time when the world should be working towards peace and de-escalation and not escalation, you know? And because their claim is so baseless, the JCPOA, it's a multilateral agreement. And it's been endorsed by the UN Security Council in the past. And the U.S. withdrew unilaterally in 2018, as we all know. And the U.S. are who violated the deal. And since then, Iran has remained in compliance with its safeguards, its obligations under the IAEA. And instead of addressing the violations and illegal attacks by the U.S. and the Zionist regime against Iran's safeguarded nuclear facilities under IAEA, the E3 are abusing the JCPOA's mechanism to impose pressure on Iran. That is in itself a double violation.
Iran has strongly condemned France, Germany, and the UK for a provocative and unlawful action at the UN Security Council. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry warned that if the move leads to the return of sanctions, the full responsibility will lie with the US and its European allies. The ministry said the push to revive sanctions lacked consensus and faced serious opposition from several council members, calling it a blow to diplomacy and a threat to the global non-proliferation regime. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister has held a phone call with the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The minister criticized the, quote, politicized atmosphere at the IAEA Board of Governors meeting, stressing that Iran's cooperation with the agency remains within international regulations. He said Iran does not accept any political action or unfair pressure that could lead to an escalation of tensions. Ukraine says its drones have targeted a major oil refinery deep inside the Russian territory for the second time this week. Russian residents in Saratov have reported hearing at least 11 explosions during the night. The major refinery is nearly 600 kilometers east of the front line in Ukraine. Ukrainian forces also launched a series of drone attacks in Russia's Kursk and Belgorod regions. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials reported that Russian drone and rocket strikes killed three civilians in Vasilivka and Poloivka. Russian forces also seized two villages in Ukraine's Donetsk and Zaporizhia regions. The conflict, which began in February 2022, has triggered a prolonged and destructive war across the region. Moscow has cited increasing NATO military presence near its borders as the root cause of the conflict. Estonia says three Russian fighter jets have violated its airspace for 12 minutes in what the Eastern European country called an unprecedentedly brazen incursion. Estonia's government said three MiG-31 warplanes entered its airspace in a very clear act of provocation. The government also said it had summoned the Russian envoy to lodge a protest and deliver a note. Estonian Foreign Minister Margus Tsahkna separately called for a strong response from NATO. Just over a week ago, Poland also said around two dozen Russian drones violated its airspace. Moscow rejected that claim as a fabrication to derail Ukraine peace talks. Venezuela strongly condemned the U.S. military's deployment of warships to the Caribbean Sea and its ongoing deadly airstrikes on Venezuelan vessels.
This amounts to an undeclared war, and you can already see how ordinary people have been executed in the Caribbean Sea without any right to a defense.
Speaking at a press conference in Caracas, Lopez urged Caribbean and Latin American nations to heighten their military readiness to confront threats from any source. He also rejected U.S.'s claims about armed drug traffickers operating in Venezuela, saying the government has not authorized any such groups to remain in the country. Tensions between Caracas and Washington have escalated since August, when the Pentagon began deploying warships to the Caribbean Sea for what it described as anti-drug trafficking operations. Since then, the U.S. military has carried out at least three deadly airstrikes on Venezuelan vessels, with the latest on Friday. President Nicolas Maduro has alleged that the U.S. military buildup aims at regime change and has called on his armed forces to prepare for any potential attack. Now with that, we bring this news bulletin to an end. It's goodbye from me, Bahman Ray.
Shines above, you're the reason I never give up. You're the one I try for, live my life for, give up all I have. You're the melody, you're the key, all the inspiration I need. And when times get tough, I know you'll stand by me. You are the love I need, the one who is God. And you know my destiny, for you are the light, and you are my life. Oh, 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 oh.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, we start this episode of today's special by the name of Allah Almighty. And then we say salam to all of you, dear brother and sister, dear listener of this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. So welcome and wait. We're going to speak about etiquette of lending money. As the ritual of this program, at first we'll look at the calendar. Today is Saturday, 27th of Rabiul Awwal, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 29th of Shahrivar, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 20th of September, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. And at first, the Holy Quran, verses 17 to 18 of chapter Taghabun is ready for you.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. In tuqridullaha qardan hasanan yudha'ifhu lakum wa yaghfir lakum wallahu shakurun halim.
If you loan Allah a goodly loan, He will multiply it for you and forgive you. And Allah is most appreciative and forbearing.
Alimul ghayb wa shahadati al-azizul hakim.
Knower of the unseen and the witnessed, the exalted in might, the wise.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
To encourage believers to expand in Allah's cause and refraining from niggardliness and covetousness, the blessed verse 17 is saying that if you lend Allah a good loan, He will make it twofold for you and He will forgive you. He, Allah, is most prepared to appreciate and reward, and He is most forbearing. Such wondrous expression is recurrently attested in the Holy Quran with respect to expanding in Allah's cause. God Almighty, who is the creator of the world of existence, and He bestows all bounties and owns all things, asks us to lend Him a goodly loan and receive a twofold compensation in return. As I told you, today we're going to learn more about the etiquette of lending money. Amid the hustle and bustle of daily life, Debt and credit transactions are common. Urgent needs often compel individuals to seek financial assistance to lighten their burdens. However, these transactions can sometimes lead to emotional and social challenges. Some lenders demand repayment without considering the borrower's circumstances, while stories abound of borrowers who evade their obligation, disappearing despite their promises to pay. The phrase, "Don't take your debts to the grave," is one many of us know well.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to today's special. This is Ali, your host. We shall be talking about the etiquettes of lending and borrowing in Islam. I hope you enjoy the discussion and stay tuned up to the end of this discussion. One of the teachings of the holy religion of Islam is the recommendation for Muslims to lend money. Lending to needy individuals who request a loan is highly emphasized in the verses of the Holy Quran and in narrations as a commendable act. In Islam, both lending and borrowing have specific etiquettes. So what is a loan or qard? Qard or loan means the transfer of ownership of a property to another person, with the recipient's obligation to repay its equivalent or its value. This definition in Islamic principles represents a financial behavior based on justice, empathy, and benevolence. In Islamic culture, a loan is not only a financial contract, but also considered a charitable and God-pleasing act. In the Holy Quran, the concept of loan is represented as qardul hasana, which means a good and commendable loan. In verse 17 of Surah Al-Taghabun, it is stated, "إن تقرض الله قرضا حسنا يضاعفه لكم ويغفر لكم والله شكور حليم." Meaning, if you loan Allah a goodly loan, He will multiply it for you and forgive you. And Allah is most appreciative and forbearing. This verse indicates the high status of Qard al-Hasana in the Islamic economic system, where the lender receives not only in this world, but also in the hereafter divine reward and forgiveness.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your hearts, a day you'll always remember every part.
Today's special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
Now, what are steps to take before you lend money? The first one is, only loan to people you trust. Anytime you lend money, you assume some level of risk. You're surrendering your money to someone else and depending on them to return it. However, you can lower your risk level if you only lend money to people you trust. But what makes a person trustworthy? You might trust a person based on previous positive interactions, or if you and a borrower have a mutual acquaintance, you may trust them based on the acquaintance's opinion. Ultimately, trust is something you have to define for yourself. When it comes to personal loans, many people only trust family and friends as borrowers. But before you lend a loved one, consider how the loan may impact your relationship with them. The Islamic perspective on debt is like this. In a world increasingly driven by customer culture and financialization, debt has become an ubiquitous aspect of life for any individuals and nations. Islam offers profound insights into the handling of debt, encouraging timely repayment and promoting a life free of debt. Debt is a serious matter in Islam. It is a responsibility that should not be taken lightly or neglected. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family used to seek refuge with Allah from being overburdened by debt, and he warned against lying and breaking promises when dealing with debt. Islam does not prohibit debt. It recognizes the fact that people may face circumstances that necessitate borrowing. However, it emphasizes caution, responsibility, and most importantly, the intention and offer to repay the debt promptly.
Based on Islamic teachings, a good loan, or qard al-hasan, is one of that comes from lawful wealth and is not spoiled by causing annoyance or placing obligation. This principle emphasizes the purity of intention and sincerity in giving the loan, meaning that a person should not diminish the spiritual value of their action by acting as a creditor and humiliating the recipient. Also, qard al-hasan essentially refers to a loan that is without interest or riba. This type of loan should be provided without charging any profit and without demanding heavy guarantees. Indeed, the goal of qard al-hasan is to help the needy and facilitate the financial affairs of members of society, not for personal gain. Therefore, in the Islamic financial system, qard al-hasan is considered an important tool for achieving social justice and solving people's economic problems. So let's have a look at the status of lending in verses and narrations. Lending holds a high status in Islam and is recommended as one of the most valuable good deeds. The whole Quran and Islamic narrations emphasize the importance of qard al-hasan and introduce it as a God-pleasing act through which the lender not only helps their fellow human but also engages in a spiritual transaction with God.
Thank you, dear brother and sister, for listening to this episode of today's special, in which we spoke about the etiquette of lending money. Shall we follow this topic? Till the next time, fi amanillah.
Show me all kind of lies. My eyes were locked, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer. I'm a believer.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. RIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Third SOB International Media Festival. The third SOB International Media Festival took place in Tehran from May 3rd to 8th, 2025, featuring prominent international media figures. A specialized session titled West Asia After the Al-Aqsa Storm was held at the IRIB Conference Center as part of the third SOB International Media Festival. The panel featured journalist, documentarian and political analyst Radwan Murtada, political activist and broadcaster David Miller, and writer and journalist Louis Alday.
With that, we're going to go ahead and get started with today's topic again, West Asia after the Al-Aqsa flood. Mr. Radwan, we want to talk a bit about the status, the shift in West Asia after the Al-Aqsa. Now, I want to quote your words. You said that during my relentless pursuit of the truth, I discovered that it has many faces, and each one of us will only believe his own definition of what truth is. These are your words.
Yes.
What do you believe? What is the truth of what is happening now in West Asia after the Al-Aqsa flood?
I want to start from the, from where he
from
finished.
From Mr. Louis or Mr. David?
From Louis.
Yes.
When you ask him, we have to write the history in a correct way.
Yes.
In fact, that we are playing on their ground, on the social media. They are managing internet. They are managing everything. The war on us. Even if you write the name of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, even if you show his face, this will be destroyed, the video will be removed. Also, if you write resistance or Shaheed or any name of our commanders, they showed as if it's a terrorist act. They threaten you to remove your page on Facebook, Instagram, even sometimes on Twitter.
Yes.
Even on TikTok, which mm-hmm. is a Chinese platform, but in fact, the censorship on TikTok is much more even than Meta. So the war is brutal on us. And I wrote that, you know, there is, everyone wants his view to truth.
Yes.
And usually I gave an example, which is about Mawlana Jalaluddin Rumi. If you look to the snake, then you will see, you'll consider the snake is harmful for you and it's the enemy. But if you look through the eyes of the snake, you will understand that it's defending herself and her wujuda.
Yes, their existence.
And her presence.
Yes.
But in fact, what's happening now in Gaza, what's happening now in Lebanon, the war against us, there is no gray space. It's even white or black. I believe that Netanyahu is the commander of the armies of the Westerns. So, and they are destroying our countries. They want to convince us there is no way to survive except surrendering for them or bowing for them. But in fact, this is not the truth.
Exactly.
There is no way for survive except the resistance. Even here in Iran, some of the Iranians, I met a lot of Iranians from different, well, some of them with the government, some of them against the government, and there is a mistaken idea that, you know, it's not our business, and let's make a deal with the America and everything.
Even though the Islamic Republic of Iran have been the biggest, if not the supporters,
yes,
of the axis of resistance in so many countries.
Yes, that's why we said if Iran is okay and in a good stance, then all of us, we are okay, because Iran knows that the price of surrendering is much more than the price of resistance,
yes,
or
exactly,
facing them.
Mr. Redwan, I saw, Mr. Louis, you were shaking your head in agreement, I believe, with what Mr. Redwan was saying. When it comes to, I mean, as being a historian, I'd like to direct this question to you on your comments on what Mr. Redwan said, and what do you believe is the current stance and shift in the region after the Al-Aqsa flood?
Be careful.
Go ahead, Mr. Louis. Yes.
I think I was particularly nodding when Redwan was saying about the idea that surrender does not equal safety. And I think that is a key message for, you know, as Redwan said, some people in Iran, some people in Lebanon, you know, this idea that the war only came because of Hizb, and if we just make peace, or if we just somehow remove Hizb, then everything will be okay. You know, viewing this as a historian, that is a completely ahistorical, at best, naive idea that is completely removed from the reality that the Zionist entity is a perpetually expansionist, inherently violent, inherently racist project that will not even accept capitulation. There will never be enough capitulation that the surrounding territories can offer it that will satisfy. It's insatiably territorially expansionist.
Yes.
And, you know, probably the most prominent example of, you know, a major Arab country that has made peace with Israel in Egypt. Since that peace agreement, Egypt has just become ever more impoverished, immiserated, harassed, and, you know, currently performing the shameful role of facilitating a genocide.
Well, exactly. I mean, just with that, let's just remind our audience and viewers that Egypt actually shares, I believe, 12 kilometers of border with Gaza, which includes the Rafah crossing. And as we all know, that we have 66 days, I believe, of a blockade, no food, no water. People are eating cat food to survive. They're eating rotten rice, unclean water, no fuel. Children are looking through the rubble to collect whatever wood they can to make fires. I mean, what role is Egypt playing in this part also?
I mean, Egypt is playing, obviously, it's beyond complicit. It's a participant, essentially. But I think this is not to defend Egypt's position, but I think something that needs to be understood about Egypt's reluctance to take in Gazans is their knowledge that if they were to do that in any, like, large-scale numbers, of course resistance would continue amongst that group of refugees, which would then give Israel the justification to begin bombing and expanding into Egypt.
So they're worried for their own well-being.
And which again shows even signing a peace agreement, even capitulating, does not equal safety, stability, and success for the country, or at least the people of the country.
Yeah. Well, Mr. David, I do want to move over to you. Let's talk a bit about Israel's status after the Al-Aqsa flood. So October 7th, 2023, Mr. Miller, we had the Al-Aqsa flood actually took place. After that, we have people saying that Israel was unable to put out the operation that happened. Israel's image obviously has been changed after the Al-Aqsa flood. Now we have so many settlers, not wanting and refusing to even join the IOF army. Where is Israel at this moment after the Al-Aqsa flood?
Thank you. I mean, let's put the case for a weakened, about to collapse Zionist entity. So yes, settlers won't join up. So yes, more than ever, people are leaving the Zionist entity, declaring they won't ever come back. Yes, their economy is a basket case. Yes, they have suffered all sorts of problems on the northern border as a result of Hezbollah, leading to thousands and thousands of settlers having to be accommodated at government expense in bed and breakfasts and hotels, where, of course, they are subject to rape by predatory Israelis, because, of course, rape is an epidemic in that society. So I could go on, but some people say as a result of that, that the Zionist entity is on the verge of collapse, as if to say, we only have to hang on a little bit and it will collapse of its own accord. And I think there's a lot to be said for that argument, but I think in the end it's misguided. They will not collapse of their own accord. They're being kept on life support by the Americans especially, but also by Germany supplying 29% of the weaponry, and also by the UK providing much of the intelligence for targeting children in Gaza, and indeed the West Bank and Lebanon, and no doubt Syria as well. So yes, of course, they're weak. Yes, of course, when the IDF comes into direct contact with Hamas or the PIJ or the PFLP or the DFLP or Hezbollah, or indeed the Iraqi resistance or Ansarallah, yes, of course, they lose. They can't fight a war face-to-face. Yes, of course, they were beaten by Hezbollah in the face-to-face conflict. But that's not the only part of the war. Hezbollah was seriously damaged by the pager attack and by the assassination campaign. The Israelis have air superiority in the whole region. There's no challenge to that. We are not seeing Israeli jets being downed on a regular basis. We saw five or six or seven Indian jets down just the other day. I saw someone, one of the comrades from Yemen, saying to Pakistan, "Can we have your air defence, please?" And that's what we desperately lack as a resistance axis. That kind of capacity. They win because of their bombing campaigns, because of their air superiority, because of their assassination campaign. And the resistance, so far, has no response or no adequate response to that.
Before I move back to Mr. Rodwan, we're going to talk about the resistance in a moment more indeed. So I do want to go back to Mr. Louis. Mr. Louis, I do want to bring up briefly, again, one of the most developments. Since we are talking about Trump, he's going to be visiting, I believe, Saudi Arabia in the next few days, the next week. And he did say that there's going to be an announcement where he's going to be, we believe, going to try to rename the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Persia into the Arabian Gulf. I mean, he's already done this over there with the Gulf of Mexico into now Gulf of America. And you as being, I believe you had a lot of research on this topic. So what do you think in regards to this?
I mean, I laughed when I saw that because, you know, it's just a cheap political stunt. But it's not this, the issue around Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf is not it's not a particularly new issue. It's been around since at least the 1950s. But having worked for many years on colonial records and archival records specifically related to the Persian Gulf, I can say with confidence that that was for hundreds of years the standardized, just the common parlance and geographical terms, including in Arabic, Khalij al-Farsi, including even, for example, letters between Arab rulers. So the idea that actually that is the correct geographical term is historically and geographically silly, and it's just a reflection of, you know, the political stunt that it is. And I think it's almost not worth talking about too much.
Yes.
In a way, because it's absurd. And much like the Gulf of Mexico, Gulf of America, is that going to actually change anything?
No, exactly.
I don't think so.
Exactly. Just him trying to push his people's buttons a little too much until perhaps one of them explode, according to what Trump tries to do these days. Mr. David Miller, as we were talking about the resistance, let's focus a bit on Gaza itself, okay, about Palestine itself. Now, we know that Gaza has been under siege for around 17 years. To be correct, but now for the past 18 months it's been facing this genocide, this televised genocide, as people are saying. Again, let's just see that everyone sees these images. Nothing's being withheld. Things are being deleted, as our guests did mention, not only on the Gaza side, but even the IOF themselves, their soldiers. They come on social media after they've kicked people out of their houses, burned them, killed them. They come and they become arrogant and showing it off and filming themselves. They say that we have joined this army because we were told that we will be allowed to go and rape young children. They say it out loud. No one's hiding anything. I mean, how can we describe what is left of the Israeli entity itself? I mean, who are these, if we can even call them people?
Well, I mean, it's very, very hard to understand or to comprehend how deeply sick and corrupt and degenerate is Israeli society. It's not just that they are racists and dehumanize the Palestinians and commit genocide. That's way worse than bad enough already. But it's that the society is so corrupt that they post these clips in glee, in the savagery with which they do it. I saw one the other day, a gender reveal party, which was a group of IDF soldiers blowing up a neighborhood, and the color of the smoke in the bombs revealed the gender of the child that was about to be born to this IDF soldier. I mean, there is no culture in the world which thinks that's remotely civilized or human. And that's something which is not just about Israel. It goes all the way through the Zionist movement. It's not just that there's a rape epidemic and a child abuse epidemic in Israel. It's throughout the whole Zionist movement. Many of the Zionist leaders in the UK, serial rapists of young children. It's a well-known thing, but we don't talk about it. We don't conceive of it in the same kind of way. So this is a sick society which has to be dismantled. It has to be removed from what was the phrase by Ahmadinejad, from the pages of history.
Yeah.
On the resistance, but I hear people saying, but there is no resistance now in Gaza. But if you have Telegram or X or Instagram, that you see Qassam brigades are active in all sorts of operations,
yeah,
which have significant material effects on executing, killing ILF operatives. So the resistance lives, and the resistance will live. The resistance isn't going to be beaten, and we already knew that. They can't beat the resistance. They can't beat Hezbollah. They can win a battle, but they can't win the battle. And that, of course, is their problem. They can't extinguish the flame,
yes,
of resistance. And we see that, of course, in Yemen, with the extraordinary scenes we see from Yemen of people simply being unafraid of U.S. imperialism, not just of Zionist imperialism, but of U.S. imperialism too. So that's the reality. And the question for me really is only how quickly can they be removed? And of course, the answer to that is not quickly enough.
Exactly. Well, Mr. Louis, you did write a year ago, it was titled 4 points on solidarity after the Gaza genocide. Now, I'm just going to read a small part from it. You said that the gravity of the settler colonial genocide in Gaza has forced us to reckon with our role as a solidarity movement. We must support the struggle of the Palestinian people to abolish Zionism, no matter the means they choose to do it. Now, I'm saying this not because that's what Mr. David Miller said. I mean, we need them out after all the atrocities they continue to carry out. What do you believe, how important is solidarity at the moment? And not just simply condemnations. How important is action now?
Do you mean primarily solidarity in the West?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I think if anything, there's been many...
By the way, he's coming from England.
Yes.
And in England, they are if you say any word, they consider it that it's supporting for Hamas or Hezbollah or,
yes,
resistance. They consider that as a crime.
Yes.
And in spite of that, he's talking.
Exactly. This is why we're all here. Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Radwan, on that point. Yes, Mr. Louis.
That is the context in which I'm speaking.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I will continue. I think there's been many painful lessons for people over the last 18 months, and I think one of them has been the inadequacy of the solidarity movement in the West, in spite of, there has been, I don't want to be excessively disparaging, for example, in the UK, there has been genuine, large-scale, popular anger, outrage, disgust, very large-scale protests, but protests that the government ignores because it doesn't care. and they don't cause sufficiently, they don't sufficiently disrupt things to force the government to take any much notice of them besides suppressing and policing them very heavily. And I think one of the reasons from before October the 7th is an insufficient understanding of the history and of Zionism and lots of embedded liberal Zionist myths within the very movements that think they're on the side of the Palestinians. For example, that the occupation began in 1967, that there can be some kind of better Israel than the one that currently exists, that the problem is Netanyahu, that the problem is the West Bank settlements and the settlers, quote unquote, there, rather the fact that we know that they're all settlers. And I think these and of course, I will not elaborate on it too much, but of course, very problematic attitudes towards armed resistance. And many people who are only willing or capable to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians as victims. And, you know, will very happily share a photo image of a child throwing a rock. But if it's someone holding an RPG, it's a different story. And I don't think that's just because of legal consequences. It's because it predates the recent legal changes regarding Hamas and other proscripted groups. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, like David said, none of this stuff is quick enough. None of this stuff is enough. It's very hard. You know, whatever I is able to do, it feels inadequate and it feels too slow. The end of Zionism cannot come soon enough. But one of the things that motivates me is trying to get people to understand what it is they're opposing or think they're opposing more clearly, which will hopefully lead to more effective, informed action. But I'm under no illusions about, you know, that the role of solidarity in the West is always going to be secondary to the actual resistance. It doesn't mean that it's unimportant, but it's always going to be secondary to the actual full range of resistance. I don't just mean militarily. I believe in all aspects of resistance.
My life has been a journey where faith is.